Welcome to the Talent Development Think Tank Podcast, the number one podcast for learning and talent development professionals. Now here's your host, Andy Storch.
Welcome to the Talent Development Think Tank Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Storch, and I'm so excited that you are joining me today for another great episode and conversation to help you up your game and improve your capabilities in the world of talent development. I've got a great one and a really wonderful guest for you today. Her name is Lan Phan, and she is an author and speaker known for her expertise in purpose, mindset, and continuous improvement. Her expertise has made her a sought-after consultant for Fortune 500 companies, where she advises CEOs and C-suite executives to help them navigate the dynamic realms of business and innovation. Her thought leadership can be found in prestigious publications like the Harvard Business Review, Forbes, and Money. And her new book, Do This Daily: Secrets for Finding Success, Happiness, and Purpose in Work and Life, comes out on April 2nd and promises to help readers completely redefine how they approach life and work. And Lan and I got acquainted, got introduced recently by our mutual friend, Mita, who connected us. And we instantly had that kind of great connection. We had so much in common in our stories and what we believe in and what we're trying to help people with. So Lan, it's just so great to have you on to share some of your story and the work you're doing with your latest book, Do This Daily.
Hey, Andy, I am so excited to be here. I've been looking forward to this call.
Yeah. And you know, this is one of those times where it's really funny. We were just chatting because we did a prep call a couple of weeks ago, and you were saying, like, I don't even like to do these prep calls because I'm so ready to go all the time and I'm with you. And I knew it wouldn't be necessary, but I thought it'd be great to connect with you. And we had this really great conversation. I'm so glad we did. But I do think it was almost a mistake because you were just sharing so much great value in that conversation. I wish that I had hit record. So we're going to have to try to do it again and bring the value this time for our listeners.
My script word by word. No, just kidding.
Word by word. I know. I think I had AI recorded. I have to go back to the transcript. We could just sit here and read. We'll go back to your background, but what is this book about? Do This Daily, and what can people expect from it?
Well, you have to really go way back, because I'm a big Marvel kind of comic book fan, and I really believe in your origin story, because I think everyone's origin story explains how we get to this book and these lessons. So my origin story is I grew up in Inglewood, California, in Los Angeles. My parents were Vietnamese refugees. We literally came here with the clothes on our backs, and my dad would have been executed if we had stayed in Vietnam. And so when we came here, my father couldn't find a job for the life of him because he was Vietnamese, and it was the 70s at that time. And so my mother supported our family of five. And I was looking at her tax returns recently, and because I was cleaning out her house because my mom has advanced dementia. And in her entire career, she worked till she was 60 something. She never made more than $15,000 a year. And she supported our family of five.
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles, yeah. And I grew up in my mother's, she ended up getting her cosmetology license because she was folding laundry at first. And that wasn't enough to support our family and feed our family. And so she worked hard, barely knew, the culture, the scientific terms. She knew English, but not very well. But she got her cosmetology license, and she ended up working at a nail and hair salon. And I ended up working there, but going there after school every day since I was six. And I started making money by cleaning the hair on the floor. And then it was that period where I kind of really started figuring out. I remember one day I told her, Mom, I'm going to, I want to quit school and become a nail technician, because I had learned how to do nail from one of the workers. And the next day I didn't return to the nail salon.
Yeah.
And then my focus at that time, my parents just wanted me to focus on studying. And I realized that was my ticket out of poverty. And so all I did was study. After school, I'd either be dropped off at the library, or I was a latchkey kid, would be at home just studying. And I got into Stanford. And in the first year, I remember I almost quit like 3-4 times. And I remember there was one period where my friend Raul, you know, I was like, I can't do this. I'm just, you know, I'm this poor refugee kid. Mm-hmm. All of these other kids at Stanford went to Exeter private schools. Yeah, who am I to be at this school? They made a mistake. And he just hugged me. And the next day I woke up and underneath my dorm room door, there was a note. And Raul had just wrote me this note, this Toni Morrison note, quote, "If you want to fly, you got to give up the shit that weighs you down."
Ooh.
And it was at that moment that I realized that I needed to let go of the stories and the insecurities and the imposter syndrome. And the other incident that happened my freshman year of Stanford was I took the psychology class. And in that psychology class, we read Viktor Frankl's A Man's Search for Meaning. Mm-hmm. And for those of you that might not know, Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor. He saw his entire family murdered, executed mm-hmm. by the Nazis. And he really wanted to understand why some people amidst great hardship and pain survived and sometimes thrived despite the circumstances. And others just withered away and gave up. And so he created this branch of psychology called logotherapy, which is a man's search for meaning, right? And so there was this one line in the book that I remember rereading over and over again. And it was this: between the stimulus, or what the things that happen to us, and our response lies a space. In that space is our freedom and the power of our response. In our response lies our happiness and mm-hmm. growth. Mm-hmm. And that quote was so life-changing for me because I realized that I wasn't a victim of my circumstance, that things weren't happening to me, they were happening for me. Yep. And that my life can change based on my response and how I started seeing that world. And I realize now that moment, taking that class and learning to kind of really deal with my insecurities, really started putting the grain in terms of really focusing on education, learning, because reading one thing could just change your life, mm-hmm. right? Just like me reading Viktor Frankl changed my life. I wasn't a victim of my circumstance growing poor and a refugee. It was something that could actually make me powerful and was my strength.
Yeah. I mean, it really can become an advantage for you, right? Like so many immigrants have become so successful because they come from such a tough background and know only the challenges and I need to work hard to rise up and help improve my situation versus someone who's just like the others, you know, people you thought you were in school with from Stanford who are like, oh, they come from these pedigrees and like they've maybe had it easy. It might even be harder for them.
Well, and it's funny, Andy, that you mentioned that. Because I recently learned that one of my super strengths is the ability to figure things out. Mm. I mean, it sounds really trivial, but just being able to, like, you know, when there wasn't food in the kitchen, I had to figure it out, mm-hmm. right? When we didn't have money to pay for this or that, I had to work, right? I was working since I was 11 or 12, and I remember creating I ended up selling candy. Like I'd go to the 99 cent store and buy like 10 cent candy and sell it for like a dollar. And I actually learned how to figure it out. If I didn't have money to pay for lunch, I would figure it out. And I think sometimes we do a disservice to our kids. My daughter's 9 right now, mm-hmm. when we try to coddle them too much. And I remember when my daughter was first born, and, you know, she started learning how to walk and stuff. She would fall when she's learning how to walk. And my motherly instinct would be to try to catch her.
Right.
And my husband would literally physically hold me back. And he said, "Let her fall."
Mm.
Right. Because my husband's Jamaican. And, you know, there's this belief that you need to fall because the world is cruel. And you learn from being able to get back up. That's how your muscle strengthens.
Yeah.
If you fall and someone always tries to hold you up, how are you going to learn? How are you going to have the fortitude and the strength in your muscles to be able to walk?
Yeah.
And so I think that was the whole notion of adversity, is that your adversity is something that's really beautiful. The things that I used to be ashamed of growing up was actually really behind the scenes making me strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you read a lot and study a lot about parenting, as I have to some extent, and really try to adopt a growth mindset, you know, I have two kids, including a daughter who's 9. One of the things people say is that they really need adversity to help them learn how to become stronger. And I have like really observe how other people parent. And I don't necessarily think I have it all figured out, but plenty of times I've been at the playground where parents are like preventing their kids from taking any kind of chances. Be careful. And I'm like, no, I'm going to take the opposite tact. I'm encouraging my kids to do hard things and stumble and fall, but it's hard. It's one of the hardest things as a parent, even as a leader, right? Because you and I have both worked with leaders in the past to see how they micromanage, because they're like, well, I can't trust this person to get things done, or I need to protect them. So I'm not going to let them stumble or come to this meeting and put their career at risk. I'll take the fall. But then you're not really giving them the experience or the opportunity to learn from those challenges.
And also just letting them know that it's okay to be imperfect. It's okay to fail. And I think of Reshma Sanjani. She was the founder of Girls Who Code, and she wrote this book called Brave Not Perfect. And it really talks about specifically how girls are raised to be perfect, right? And boys are taught to be brave, and how that impacts humans or people as they get older. Because, you know, and you can see this in any school ground or playground that you go to. Boys are jumping off of two-story, you know, structures, and girls like, be careful. You know, there's always a double standard with my family, where my mother just wanted, you have to be prim, you have to be proper.
Right.
And then even if you think about sports, right, boys are, you know, playing in the mud, they're playing football, you know, basketball. Girls are usually in the past driven towards like ballet, gymnastics, things where you're competing against each other. And it's about perfection. If you think about ballet and dancing, it's about being perfect.
Right.
And then you grow up and you see social media and everything is curated. Mm-hmm. Girls are supposed to look a certain way. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think when we create this culture where you have to be perfect, it's a disservice to other people. Because even if you think about being an entrepreneur, it takes a lot of risk.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of failure and ideation.
Yeah.
And if you're too afraid to take risks, if you're too afraid to take that first step, how do you advance? How do you grow?
Yeah.
I've learned more from my failures than I have ever from any of my victories.
Yeah. Well, likewise, I try to learn from both, but I think we do often learn from our failures. So you're publishing this book. I know you work with a lot of people. We both talk with a lot of people about career changes. You've had, you know, certainly you had that very, very pivotal moment in college, but you also had another pivotal moment in your career years later that sort of was the crux that sent you on this journey toward writing this book and helping so many people, right? And kind of discovering the direction for you to go. Can you talk more about that?
Definitely. So it was 2019. I had gotten hired by Alan Murray, the CEO of Fortune magazine. Prior to this, I was a serial entrepreneur. I would come into companies, spend their millions of dollars, and build businesses and startups within their companies. Hmm. So Alan Murray had recruited me to build a membership community, a startup within Fortune called Fortune Connect. And, you know, this was probably the end of 2019. Start of January, I was given a multi-million dollar budget to create a startup from nuts to boats in 6 months, which is very ambitious if you've ever, you know, started or work in the startup world. And so I was supposed to hire a team of 100. I got to hire number 5, and then the pandemic happened, and then I got laid off. And not only did I get laid off, I had to lay off my entire team. And some of them had left jobs a week before. And so it was the beginning of the pandemic. My husband, because it was the pandemic, had also lost his job. He was laid off. So we had no income coming in. I was also supporting my mother financially, who has advanced dementia now, and she was in her 80s at the time. And I just fell into a deep depression. And I think one of the reasons why was that I had identified success and happiness based on my profession for so long, and my title and how much money I made. And when I lost it, I was just like, who am I? And I remember my daughter because I'd literally been in the same sweatpants for probably a week, was in bed, like barely left the bed. And when I did, I was just crying uncontrollably during random parts of the day. And I just heard this voice, my daughter, she was, you know, in the bedroom, and she just said, "Mommy, I love you even without a job." And that was the voice I needed to kind of pull me out of this deep despair, because I realized that I was taking on the victim mode, right? That space between the stimulus and the response lies our power. And I was letting go of my power. I was a victim, right? And so I refocused my attention from being laid off. And I basically met with the five girls that were working with me at Fortune. And I was like, "I'm going to either help you find your next job, or I'm going to build my business and hire you back." And that was kind of the start of Community of Seven, because there was five of them, myself and my daughter, Morgan, who was five at that time. And she was number seven. So that was Community of Seven. So I started my business not really having an idea of what I was building, but I knew that it would be called Community of Seven. So I created a website, and then I started iterating. And the first iteration was really working with CMOs and executives, because that was what I had been doing for the past decade, working with executives, CEOs, founders, CMOs. I had built the CMO practice at the ANA, had helped as a general manager, a CHER, the Gender Equality Initiative for the advertising industry. So I knew that world. And so I basically had different executives that would bring up, and we would do masterminds. And I actually covered the topics that I now talk about and do this daily. What I realized, though, was that in that process, what was really important for my transformation was really understanding what mattered most to me. And I realized that in the past, I based it on external factors, how much money I made, what title I had, and I was miserable. And I started to change things around, because before I would find a job and then I would try to place everything else around it. And what inevitably happened is the work would just kind of spread out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for example, I traveled 85% of the time. I barely saw my daughter and my husband. So even though I thought that Fortune was my dream job, I was coming home at 10 o'clock at night. So I would only see my daughter on the weekends. And even by the weekend, I was too exhausted to be present as a mother. And so I really started to pause and ask those important questions. Number one being, what matters most to me? What are my core values? And I realized it was my family, my friends who are my chosen family, my faith, being of service to others, and freedom. And none of my jobs in the past fulfilled any of that. And so I created this whole 4-point kind of guide. And then I would basically meet with these CEOs and executives, some of them who had been pretty senior presidents, C-suite executives at these major Fortune 10 companies. And that was kind of the start of Community of Seven. And then I realized after a year that that wasn't my mission and purpose, that I wanted to help more people. And so I started broadening it around and doing more training and development for companies, doing mass trainings with like 300, 150 people virtually.
What an amazing story. And you have gone through so many challenges, and that has really pushed you to dig deep and think about what's really most important to you. Something that a lot of people don't take the time to sit down and really think about. I mean, I think if you ask people, they'll say, family or faith or friends are important to me. But then it's the sort of the old cliche of like, well, let's look at your calendar and see where you're actually spending your time, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people might hear your story and say, well, that's great that you came to this realization and then you built this new thing around that. Family is most important to me, but I also need to make money. And I have this really demanding job I'm working 60 hours a week, and I don't necessarily know how to change that. What would you say to that? I'm sure you've worked with those people.
No, definitely. What I always say is one of the first questions I would ask to these executives that I work with is this simple question: what brings you joy? 95% of the time, it's quiet and they can't answer it. And when they do answer it, it's usually kind of some family, religion, whatever it is, right? The faith.
Yeah.
But they don't really dig deeper into that. And life is like a GPS. You need an address in order for the GPS to be functional. if you still could, you know, get to where you want to go if you don't have the address, but you might get lost. You might, you know, fall off a cliff. You might have to U-turn. And so when you're intentionality in life is like that address in the GPS. And if what matters most to you is service or being with your family, and if you don't prioritize that, if you're not intentional about it, other things will take the space. And here's the thing with the argument about, but I need to pay bills,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's funny, I think about, and I think I told you this before, this Netflix comedian was talking about Frank Ocean. He's like this rapper. Mm. He's super successful, but he's not on the red carpets. You don't hear any drama about him. He's not doing the press circuit, but he consistently releases hits, like yeah. his albums sell.
Yeah.
And the comedian went up to him and was like, how do you do it, Frank Ocean? Like, you just release all of this great work and you're not in the drama, the Hollywood drama.
Yeah.
And the guy pauses, Frank pauses, and he says, I make less money.
Hmm.
Right?
Yep.
So you might have to make less money, right? You might initially, until you find your thing, it's going to be uncomfortable, right? Yep. When I first started Camino 7, I wasn't making as much as I was making as an executive, but now I do. It just takes a while to build what you want to build. But part of that is having the faith. And there was this one advice when I first started my first business years ago, my lawyer, and he was like probably in his 60s or 70s at that time, had, you know, created a lot of successful businesses. And I, you know, I told him, like, how do I start a business? How do I support myself? It's, you know, it's scary. And he was like, Lan, it's really simple. You know, you spend less than you make and you invest the rest, right? Yeah. And I think so many of us, and excuse my French, we just believe all of the bullshit that society tells us, that our value is based on what we wear, what we drive. And then we try to keep up with the Jones.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yes, you have a mortgage, you have all this other stuff, but I would rather much live a simple life
mm-hmm.
where I have freedom.
Yeah.
And so I identified pretty early on that freedom was a priority.
Mm.
So freedom is probably one of the most valuable things that you can have.
Yeah.
And most of us are slaves to our jobs.
True. And freedom can mean different things to different people, right? I don't want people to think that you're saying, well, in order to be happy, I need to go start a business. And,
No, not at all.
A lot of people have no interest in doing that, right? They like
exactly.
for big companies. They like being part of teams. They like working in talent development in an organization and really being a chance to develop others, which I want to get into. But there's different elements of freedom. It's more of just having some freedom of your time to be able to engage in the things that really light you up and make you happy.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm not saying discouraging from corporate living,
right?
But I'm just saying finding the right places that nurture your soul.
Yeah.
Places that,
like finding the right company or having more boundaries.
Right manager,
more boundaries, right? Taking mental health breaks and time for yourself. And really, like, I talk about this too in my courses and content and book. It's like, connect back with your priorities, the things that are most important to you, and build in time for that. You ask the question, what brings you joy? I think for a lot of people, the obvious answer will be family or faith or giving back or helping others. Those are definitely the top things, but it's okay to also have things just for you, right? Like hobbies that you enjoy doing. And it's okay to make time for those things. Like, I really like cycling. I like riding my bike. I like getting outside and getting exercise. I make time to do that 2 or 3 times a week, and it really fills me up and it gives me more energy to do other things.
I think also that even though you might not identify a specific value as being important to you, there are, you know, so for example, my family is the most important thing to me. So money and a livelihood is important because I can't pay my mortgage. We can't have a roof over our heads.
Right.
You know, I can't have, you know, ensure that my daughter goes to college. If there's not money coming out, it's not just about passion,
yeah.
you know, health, right? I didn't say health is a priority,
Yeah,
but true. One of my goals is to be able to be here long enough to see my mother, my daughter, Morgan, get married and have kids and be a grandparent. Right. And in order for me to do that, I have to take care of my health.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And I want to, you know, I mentioned my mother is dying of dementia. I don't want to just live long. I want to be mentally present. So sometimes our core values, you know, push us to do other things because it's not just the one thing. Right. At all costs. It's about I need to be in order to be a present mother. I need to take care of my health. I need to be financially stable. Right. Yeah. I think about the whole ikigai and the four concentric circles. Right. It's about what you love doing, what you're good at, but also what the world needs and what you can get paid for. Mm-hmm. Because I might be a great singer, but if I can't get paid for it. Yeah, there's going to be no shelter. There's not going to be food on the table.
Yeah.
Right.
100%. We got to think about all those things. I love the mantra. A lot of people are saying now health is wealth, right? You know, forget all the cars and all that sort of stuff, but like being healthy at 40 or 50 is like the new flex kind of thing. And I think it's really important. I think people think about taking care of their health for the long term. I want to come back, you know, from a corporate perspective for people that are in roles that are, you know, involved in developing others, whether they're leaders or working in talent development, whatever it may be. Maybe come back to that core four that you mentioned. And then how does that relate to someone who is trying to help others in an organization?
Definitely. So the four, what I call secrets, but they're not really secrets because you should already know this. But, you know, the four, what I call the four kind of path are these. Number one is be able to identify what matters most to you, right? The intentionality, really being able to identify your core values. Number two is your mindset creates your destiny, which is, you know, I think of, you know what, I'm going to go over the four first and then I'll dig deep into each of them. So I mentioned two, your mindset creates your destiny. Number three is change requires consistency. And number four is change requires changing who we are. So digging a little bit deeper, you know, we already talked about what, you know, the core values, what matters most. It's not enough to just know your values and what's important to you. You have to live them. You have to make sure your core values are your North Star, that it informs everything that you do. So, for example, there was a disconnect when I said my family was the most important thing to me, but I was never at home. Yeah. I wasn't seeing my daughter. There's a disconnect. And so you need to make sure that there is congruency with the things that are important to you and how you live your life. So the second one is really about your mindset. And I think about the Henry Ford quote, if you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
Yeah. Whether you think you can or you can't, you're right.
Right. Exactly. And it's this kind of this notion of belief, like whether you have, you know, I talk a little bit about the whole notion of growth mindset and fixed mindset and Carol Dweck's work. And it's really this belief that you can get better with time, that we're not just born with innate skills, that we develop them and how we deal with every part of our lives has an impact. The third one really is about, you know, and I think I'm really happy that Atomic Habits by James Clear, BJ Fogg on Tiny Habits has become very talked about. It's really the daily habits and systems that change who we are, not these big overnight, you know, the Biggest Loser kind of experiences. And this is why I call the book Do This Daily. And it's really about, you know, once you understand your values and you really work on your mindset, it's about the small decisions and things that you do daily that make a huge impact on our lives. And the last one is really about the art of becoming. Mm-hmm. And I always say that change is simple, but it's not easy. There's really only two ways to change your life: the things you add in your life and the things that you take away. And remember that Toni Morrison quote I said earlier, if you want to fly, you got to give up the shit that weighs you down. Mm-hmm. And I think about there's four really quadrants that most people need to change. Mm-hmm. One is the habits and the systems. Number two, three is really about your environment, and four, your community, who you surround yourselves with. Mm-hmm. And there were studies done with people who had alcoholism and drug issues. And the ones that went back to their original environments usually relapsed. And the other ones that found a either moved to a completely new environment or leaned into something like Alcoholics Anonymous were more successful in making the change. And I think if we want real change, we need to change all the aspects in our lives that are congruent with the person we want to be. We kind of have to earn and become the people who deserve what we want. So this is the whole notion of do this daily. Is true transformation is this unwavering understanding of what you want and doing the daily actions with your mindset and your behavior and your environment and your systems and your community that leads to the lasting change.
Yeah. I like what you said there. If we want real change, we have to change all the other aspects of our lives or all the aspects of our lives, because hope is not a strategy, right? Mm-hmm. It's great to have hope, but it's not a strategy. One I always repeat often in my keynotes and whatnot is that a goal without a plan is really just a wish, right? Mm-hmm. And so we don't have a plan. If we're not making the necessary changes, then things are probably not going to change. So if we're unhappy with some aspect of our life, we need to take a look at that, or our career, take a look at that and say, what do I like about it? What do I not like about it? What are the things that I want to change? And if I can't make a huge, big shift today, what are the smaller habits that are going to get me there? What mindset shift that can I make that will make me happier? Can I shift how I spend my time? Those sort of things. I think these things are all really, really important. I agree with all of them on an individual level. I'm curious from an organizational perspective, if you're talking to leaders or someone in a position to be developing and working with others, how can they take this to help other people around them and their organization?
Yeah. I think one of the big things, so I just did a training for 160 employees at this PR agency. And one of the most important things is that making sure that there's buy-in from the very top, which is the CEO. And there was a pivotal moment. I had done my training, my keynote, and they were talking about the year ahead, right? And the CEO, it just kind of came, stood up and just said, and they were talking about some policy about coming in at 9 o'clock. And she was like, if you have to commute and you need to come late, make sure that there's no calls after 10. And if your manager has a problem with it, you come to me as a CEO. And any change that has to happen, you have to have buy-in from the bottom to the top. And I think, one of the issues that companies have, especially with core values, is that their own employees don't understand them. And I think the first thing is really understanding, especially when you're talking about values, like company values, mission statements, et cetera, is that there has to be buy-in. And one of the powerful things that this company had, they already had their core values when I came in and did my training. They actually created it together. So they had a retreat the year prior and everyone was a part of creating these values. And my talk was out really about how do you now actually live it? And we live it through the daily decisions that we make, and everyone has ownership. Doesn't matter if it, like one of their number one value was people first, which I think is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, how do you actually live it? Right? It's not just the customer relation team that owns that. It's if you are at the front desk, how do you treat a delivery service, a delivery person? Do you treat them the same as a CEO or a client? If you are people first, you live and breathe it with every action and within everyone in the organization. The CEO is venerated more than someone who's an EA, right? And that's very difficult because I think sometimes when we make these core values, we don't necessarily apply it to everyone within the organization. That's when there's disconnect. So I think in order for learning and development to take place, people need to feel like they own it and that everyone within the organization, that they're an important part in making it come to life.
Yeah, it has to be supported from the top. It's really about creating that culture of ownership, of really leaning into some of these principles and, you know, figuring out what is going to help the overall organization be successful as well as individuals on the team. And if you're going to come up with values, and if you're going to say people first, like, are you living it? So are you living in alignment, working in alignment with these values? Same as you talked about for us as individuals. The last thing I wanted to ask you about was this idea of defining success and happiness. You mentioned earlier that you had spent a lot of your career defining success based on external factors, money, title. This is not uncommon at all. This is very common. Yeah. Most people don't even realize that the idea of success is so personal. It's different for everybody, but a lot of times it's based on what we grew up thinking about. It's, you know, successful people have a lot of money or have a title or a lot of respect or followers or, you know, whatever it may be. And we don't know everything that's going on with those people. How do you think about success today, and how should other people be thinking about success for themselves?
I mean, I don't think I'm in a position to talk about how other people should define success, because I think everyone has their own definition of success, and that is how it should be, right? Mm-hmm. My success, really, as I've gotten older, has just been around how can I leave the world a little bit better than I found it? And how can I help as many people as I can?
Yeah.
For me, that's happiness. And if I can support my family and do the things I love, that's just a bonus.
Yeah, that's really nice too. I think about success as being really happy and fulfilled and content with my life. Like, if I'm happy with my life, that's success. And I find that's a really good thing to come back to deal with the comparison stuff that comes up all the time. Like, oh, that person has more money than me or has a better title or a nicer car. Or like, well, they may or may not be happy with their lives, but if I'm happy with my life, then none of the rest of that stuff matters.
Comparison is the thief of joy. It is so true. And I work with so many seemingly really successful people, and a lot of them aren't happy, right? Because when you base it on what title you have, let's say, or what company you work for, you retire, you leave the job, and all of the prestige and power that you had no longer is bestowed to you, because that prestige and the power was bestowed to the title that you have, but you no longer have that title.
Yeah.
So you go home to your children or your family and they barely know you. Right. And so I think at the end of the day, And this applies for organizations as well, it's your people that are your heart and your soul of any company, not the product, because the people are what creates the products and the services, right? And the reminder, this is what I always remind myself when I'm walking into any situation or when I manage people, is that the impact that I make into their lives can impact their future lives. You know, you think about generational curses, it's also generational wealth, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the decision of my mom to not have me go back to the beauty salon to make $8 haircuts and $30, you know, full sets, I changed the direction for my daughter, right? All of those different career choices of companies and bosses that gave me a chance when they didn't need to basically changed the trajectory of my entire family.
100% comes down to people, comes down to mindset, our decisions, how we choose to perceive the world and how we choose what we choose to pursue with our work and with our lives. Lan, we got to wrap this up. This has been fantastic. We could talk for hours about these subjects. I think there's so much important work to be done here. So many important things to tell people. The book is called Do This Daily: Secrets for Finding Success, Happiness, and Purpose in Work and Life. It comes out on April 2nd. I know you can go and pre-order it now on Amazon. Anything else you want to let people know before we go?
No, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here, Lan. And hang on, because we have our bonus Q&A. For those of you listening, I hope that this was viable for you, was inspirational like it was for me. You took some notes. Just think about, what's that one thing you can do today? Can you sit down? Can you make time? later today, tomorrow morning, to write down your values, who you are, what gives you joy, and then start to think about what are those small changes you can start making to create more of that joy in your life, to live more of your values. I think if you did that, that would make a huge impact for you and possibly your family and the people around you. As always, you can find out more information about our podcast, our membership community, and our conference, everything we do on our website, tdtt.us. I appreciate you listening and sharing with others, and I will talk to you next time.